I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we round out our series on the Israel-Palestine conflict. This time, we're speaking with international law scholar and former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Territories, John Dugard. Born in South Africa, John was actually one of the most outspoken critics of the apartheid regime in that country until its demise in the waning years of the 20th century. Since then, he has turned his attention to the issue of Palestinians, human rights, and international law, and has argued that apartheid is an issue in the Israel-Palestine conflict. And he was doing so many years before Human Rights Watch and the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem invoked apartheid in reports published by the two organizations this year. In this conversation, John and I will speak about such matters as apartheid, as well as the International Criminal Court, the situation in Sheikh Jarrah as it relates to the latest spat between Hamas and Israel, the role the international community will likely have to play if there is progress to be made in the resolution of this conflict long term, and why John feels that the United States has disqualified itself in being able to broker peace in the Israel-Palestine conflict. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. I should note that this interview was conducted just mere hours before the announcement that a ceasefire has been reached between Israel and Hamas. So please keep that in mind while listening. And now on to the conversation with international law scholar John Dugard. Washington, D.C. Place of stately discourse.
Bare knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want the dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I feel is very timely for my audience, given what is happening right now in the Middle East. John Dugard, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
So, John, for my listeners, I have a lot of younger listeners that may be unfamiliar with your incredible, really, career and work. Could you fill my listeners in on some of your background, your work at the UN, and also opposing apartheid in South Africa?
Well, I'm a South African, That's the starting point. And I lived in South Africa for the whole of the era of apartheid in South Africa. I was a professor at one of the leading universities in South Africa in Johannesburg. And I also directed a unit attached to the university, the Center for Applied Legal Studies, whose task it was to engage in advocacy and litigation in order to promote human rights. So in other words, I was deeply involved in the opposition to apartheid in South Africa during that period. At the end of apartheid, I was involved in the constitutional talks. I worked mainly on the construction of a Bill of Rights for South Africa in the new 1996 South African Constitution. In the late 1990s, I was appointed to the International Law Commission, which is a UN body which deals with the codification of international law. And then I was about to retire from the University of Witwatersrand, and I was offered a position at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. And so I've been in the Netherlands ever since. For the last 20 years, I've been involved in international law issues and in human rights and justice in Palestine. For 15 years, I was a member of the International Law Commission. And for 7 years, I was United Nations Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. And for 18 years, I sat intermittently as a judge of the International Court of Justice. After I ceased to be Special Rapporteur for Palestine, I continue to be actively engaged in the promotion of justice in Palestine. And one could say that that is my main pursuit at present.
Now, in terms of what is happening right now in Israel and Palestine, you know, we had the issue with expulsions in Sheikh Jarrah. And we also have had a lot happening with the Human Rights Watch report and the B'Tselem report. Where do you want to start with that? What do you think the key points are in understanding what is happening right now?
Well, let me go back a little bit further to refer to one of the main events in the year, and that is the initiation of an investigation into crimes committed in Palestine by Israel and by militant Palestinian groups before the International Criminal Court. And what is important to stress is that one of the matters that the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court will be investigating or is investigating is the question of apartheid. It is argued that the establishment of a settlement enterprise in Palestine has resulted in a system of apartheid in which there are two groups, the settlers numbering some 700 or 800,000, and the Palestinians, and the settlers are treated favorably in much the same way as white South Africans were treated during the apartheid period. So the International Criminal Court is considering the issue of apartheid. But it's been very difficult for the international community to accept the notion that Israel practices apartheid along the same lines as that of the South African government. And this argument has now been given a major boost by the Human Rights Watch report, which examines the practices and policies of Israel in Palestine and comes to the conclusion that it resembles apartheid as it was practiced in South Africa. But more importantly, it qualifies as a crime of apartheid in terms of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. And my impression is that the Human Rights Watch report has had a major impact on public opinion. I don't think it's had much impact on governments. The governments of Western states have not committed themselves on the subject, but I suspect that the United States, United Kingdom, and member states of the European Union are not prepared to accept this notion. And there are a number of reasons for this. I think today that one must accept that anyone who argues that Israel, which is supposed to be the only democracy in the Middle East, which is a major question, is responsible for applying a heinous policy of apartheid. And this is seen to be a form of anti-Semitism by Israel and in many quarters. And political figures are very reluctant to be labeled as anti-Semitic. And so one finds that the notion that Israel practices apartheid in Palestine and indeed in Israel itself has not been accepted by political leaders, although it has had a major impact, I believe, on public opinion. So I think that's one of the major events of this year in the context of Israel and Palestine.
I just wanted to add real quick. So when it comes to the Human Rights Watch report, the response I hear from some of the defenders of Israel that were very upset with the Human Rights Watch report, they'll say that the report itself doesn't say that apartheid is exactly like it was in South Africa. But I think that criticism, I mean, it seems to fall flat. I mean, if apartheid is going on, it doesn't have to be exactly like South Africa to be a bad thing, you know?
Yes, well, you're absolutely correct. In 1998, after the fall of apartheid in South Africa, the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court was adopted, and that defines the crime of apartheid. Essentially, it consists of certain inhumane acts committed by one group against another group, where the one group is dominant and oppresses the other group. And so the Human Rights Watch report has approached the subject of apartheid from that perspective. It hasn't gone into the subject of the similarities between apartheid in South Africa and in Palestine. But let me say that I spent my whole, or most of my adult life, living under apartheid in South Africa. I know what apartheid in South Africa was like. I spent a lot of time in the Middle East as a special rapporteur, and I've also conducted two international investigations into events in Palestine, first into the Second Intifada, and in 2009 into the attack on Gaza and Operation Cast Lead. And so I like to think that I know what is happening in the Palestinian territory. And there are remarkable similarities. In some respects, in many respects indeed, the apartheid practiced by Israel is worse than that practiced by apartheid South Africa. What has troubled me, for instance, in recent times is the racist rhetoric that emanates from Israel. It's far worse than anything I ever heard in South Africa. And of course, there's the brutality of the attack on Gaza. That was not a feature of apartheid in South Africa. So I don't think one can really argue that the Human Rights Watch report is to be faulted on the ground that it doesn't deal with the exact similarities between the two systems. I would go so far as to say that apartheid is practiced in Palestine is probably worse, certainly in many respects, than it was in apartheid South Africa.
If I could, and I want to get into Sheikh Jarrah, because I think some media analysis of what has been happening lately has kind of neglected that issue. But I also wanted to ask you about this issue of occupation. I was talking to Phyllis Bennis earlier, and she pointed out how both you and your successor as special rapporteur on the occupied territories, Richard Falk, sort of discussed how the occupation is very unusual in how long it has lasted. And we may even need new terms in international law to describe this occupation. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Yes, well, occupation, military occupation, is really intended to be a temporary state of affairs. It is designed to allow a state which has occupied, militarily occupied a territory, to continue the occupation until a peaceful settlement is reached. And the international law recognizes that this will be done within a reasonable period of time. But in the case of the Middle East, we have a prolonged occupation, which sees no end. And it's quite clear that Israel is determined not to end the occupation because the occupation is simply a convenient name for annexation of the Palestinian territory. In some cases, there's been formal annexation, as in the case of East Jerusalem, but in other areas, there has been de facto informal annexation. And this has led many to argue, and I include myself in that group, to argue that the occupation is today an illegal occupation and must be brought to an end for this reason, as well as the fact that it is has been prolonged unnecessarily.
So for people, I have younger listeners that are only just becoming interested in the issues of international law, you know, and I think sometimes we neglect to define terms. What do we mean by annexation for listeners that may be unfamiliar?
By annexation, we mean that one state asserts its sovereignty over another state, that it claims that the territory of another state belongs to it. So in the case of East Jerusalem, Israel claims that that territory is no longer part of Palestine. It is now part of Israel, and it falls under the sovereignty of Israel.
So in regards to the expulsions happening in Sheikh Jarrah, and that's the one of the initial reasons I contacted you, what would you say about this development? Because it's, you know, it's very tragic in my view.
Well, I think one has to see Sheikh Jarrah in the wider context. The seizure of Palestinian properties and the destruction, demolition of Palestinian properties is a feature of the occupation. This is an interesting case because it has been continuing for so long. Essentially, what has happened is that in 1948, Sheikh Jarrah fell under Jordan, and not under Israel. And during that period, Palestinian families were given the right to live in certain houses. And then in 1967, Israel conquered the city of Jerusalem and later annexed the city of Jerusalem. And now a number of Jewish families have claimed that the properties belonged to them before 1948, and they are entitled to get their properties back. And that's essentially what the argument is all about. But of course, takes no account of the fact that as a result of these changes, many Palestinian families were deprived of their homes in West Jerusalem and other parts of Israel, and they are not entitled to get their homes back. But the legal proceedings involving Sheikh Jarrah have gone on for many years, and they have now reached a culmination where the families in question are about to be evicted. And it has become really a symbol of the Israeli seizure of Palestinian properties and the determination on the part of Israel to make Jerusalem a Jewish city, whereas Palestine claims that Jerusalem is the capital of Palestine. And so that's why it is such a sensitive issue.
And there's also, of course, the issue of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But I think a lot of focus has been put on Hamas launching rockets. What do you think about that? Because I think that Hamas has committed war crimes, but that doesn't really justify Israeli airstrikes that end up really just killing civilians, many of whom are minors.
Well, I think it's important to stress that Hamas decided to embark upon the present program of firing rockets into Israel in response to the events in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's important to stress that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a very important mosque in the Muslim world, and the way in which Israeli forces entered the mosque and fired tear gas and sun grenades was really a shock to the whole Muslim world, and also to Palestine in particular, and to Hamas. Because the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah is not able to respond to actions of this kind, Hamas took the initiative. And so we saw Hamas and Islamic Jihad embark upon a program of firing rockets into Israel, most of which have been intercepted by the Iron Dome. Israel argues that it has been acting in self-defense, but this takes no account of the fact that Hamas and Islamic Jihad are really responding to the events in Al-Aqsa Mosque. And so it's ridiculous for President Biden and other leaders to argue that Israel is entitled to act in self-defense in response to these attacks. There's another reason why this is ridiculous, and that is because Israel does not recognize Palestine as an independent state or does not recognize Gaza as an independent state. Self-defense is a concept that applies when one state attacks another state, and that clearly has not happened here. Essentially, Israel is engaged in a policing operation. It's policing its occupation of Gaza. And in so doing, it is bound to international humanitarian law. Israel, as the occupying power, is subject to international humanitarian law, to the 1949 Geneva Conventions, which make it clear that the occupying power is obliged to administer the occupied territory in accordance with certain rules. And one of these rules is that it should not engage in collective punishment or should not target civilians or use force disproportionately. And it's quite clear that Israel has violated these obligations. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have also committed war crimes by firing rockets indiscriminately into Israeli territory. But Israel has used force to a much greater degree, as is reflected in the fact that over 230 people have been killed in Gaza compared with 12 in Israel. And of course, the damage to property and to the infrastructure of Gaza is considerable.
I was going to add to that. I mean, it just seems like there's a massive sort of power imbalance in this conflict because, I mean, the Gazans don't have, you know, bunkers and whatnot. They don't have an iron dome in the way that Israel does.
Of course, the whole, I think one must take account of the fact that Israel is one of the most developed countries in the world when it comes to weaponry. And this is in large measure due to the United States, because the United States has supplied Israel with the most sophisticated modern weapons. And we all know that it pays $3.8 billion to Israel every year for military defense, almost by way of tribute. And now there's an attempt to pay another, what is $700 million to Israel for further military equipment. So Israel is well armed, put mildly, and it has used that weaponry with great success in order to destroy the infrastructure of Gaza and to kill many innocent people. And I think one must accept that the argument that Israel does not target civilians is not supported by the evidence. Women and children have been killed. The Israeli Defense Force might argue that this is all by way of collateral damage, but the state is obliged to take steps to ensure that collateral damage of this kind, injury or death to civilians, is not committed. And the evidence suggests that civilian targets, civilians have been targeted by Israel in Gaza.
So it seems like there's a pretty just almost open and shut case to say that what Israel has been doing, it constitutes human rights violations.
Well, it constitutes human rights violations, but more important, the International Criminal Court, to which I referred at the beginning, is examining not only the crime of apartheid, but also the violation of international humanitarian law, particularly the targeting of civilians. So, Israel's action has simply aggravated the evidence before the International Criminal Court against Israel.
So I had a relative recently ask me this question, and I thought I would pose it to you. They said, what is the end game of this occupation? Why is there this permanent occupation? What is the reason for continuing this?
Well, the end game is land. The Zionist dream is that Israel will be territory from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River. And Israel wishes to exercise sovereignty over the whole of what is today the West Bank and East Jerusalem. I don't think Israel is particularly interested in Gaza. It would prefer to see Gaza attached in some way to Egypt or for Gaza to drop off the face of the earth. But when it comes to the West Bank, Israel wants to annex the territory. And we see that to a large extent it has done this by establishing what can only be described as a colonial empire in the West Bank with 700 to 800,000 settlers in some 150 settlements. And so you do have a colonial regime in the West Bank. And that really indicates the determination of Israel to reclaim, as it were, the territory of Palestine for the Zionist dream of Israel.
Just a few more brief questions here. The one I really wanted to get to because of your involvement as a UN Special Rapporteur, and I thought you would be able to give some insight on this. We have the UN National Security Council now trying to make a statement about the current flare-ups in this conflict, and the U.S. is blocking it. I was wondering if I could get your comment on that.
Well, let me just look at this in historical context. Palestine has always believed that the acceptance of Palestine as an independent state depends very much on the United States. And Arafat and Abbas have always gone running to the United States in the first place for establishing a peace process which would result in the acceptance of Palestine as an independent state. But I think that what has happened in the last couple of weeks is that it has become very clear that the United States has in effect disqualified itself as an honest broker because it has vetoed or blocked all resolutions in the Security Council. And one must bear in mind that the Biden administration continues to keep its embassy in Jerusalem. This was a move done by President Trump, but Biden is not prepared to rescind this step and to take the embassy back to Tel Aviv. And of course, there's all the money that the United States pays to Israel in order to equip its army. So it's become very clear that some other states will now have to take the initiative in engaging in a peace process. And it seems incumbent upon the Security Council as a whole and states like United Kingdom, France, and inevitably China and Russia to take the initiative because the United States has simply walked away from the peace process.
I was going to add to that. I feel like the problem we face now is that there are elements within Israeli political life that are even farther right than Netanyahu. I mean, I just had a guest on telling me that in a way you could argue that certain Kahanist elements have gone more and more mainstream over the years. It sounds like the ultra-nationalism in Israel, it can't be really leashed anymore. It's out of control. And I think that there needs to be involvement by the international community in order for there to be any chance of human rights being respected when it comes to Israel and Palestine.
Yes, well, the international community has to become involved. The question is, how can it do that? I don't see a situation in which the Security Council is going to impose sanctions on Israel as it does in the case of, as it did in the case of South Africa. To a large extent, it all depends upon the International Criminal Court. But I think it's important to stress that public opinion is shifting. And one of the reasons for the shifting opinion is the extreme right-wing rhetoric and behavior that is manifested in Israel today. And as I said to you some time ago, this is worse than anything I ever experienced in South Africa. I read in the New York Times today that there's an app for mobilizing right-wing Israeli support, which goes under the name of Death to Arabs. Now, that kind of genocidal rhetoric is totally unacceptable, and it inevitably is going to change, but of course this takes time. I think civil society has an important role to play in this whole issue, and Israel is clearly aware of that, and that's why Israel is so determined to label BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions as anti-Semitic, because it realizes that civil society, rather than foreign governments, will ultimately change the situation.
Now, before we close out, the question that keeps coming into my mind is, you know, even if there's a ceasefire, and some people have said maybe we'll see that by the end of this week, I feel like my concern is we may keep seeing things like this every few years. And I just want to know, is there any possibility of seeing this stop and also seeing Palestinians treat it with basic human dignity? I mean, could there ever be a sea change in our lifetimes?
Well, I think, yeah, the South African experience is relevant, that in order to change, I think the ordinary Israeli will have to realize that he or she is to some extent seen as an outcast by the international community, and this behavior cannot continue. And this must be accompanied by economic sanctions of the kind envisaged by BDS. It's a slow process, but Israel does have to be subjected to the same kind of pressure that apartheid South Africa was subjected to. And I think that if that is done, Israel will change its approach, and this will result either in a two-state solution, independent Palestine and independent Israel, or in a single state of Palestine. But of course, the problem there for Jewish Israel is that the Jews will be in the minority. And so that does have far-reaching implications for the Jewish community. And that's why I think the West prefers the two-state solution. But unfortunately, the West is not doing enough or anything to promote the two-state solution at present.
So do you think there's hope for change in the future?
I'm an optimist by nature, but I must confess that I'm really despondent when it comes to the Middle East. I don't see governments changing. I think governments are very afraid of being labeled as anti-Semitic. Some governments are very conscious of Holocaust guilt. If you take Germany and the Netherlands, the memory of the failure of their failures during the Second World War has still affected foreign policy. So I think it would be some time before Western governments are prepared to acknowledge the need for change. But I think that public opinion is changing, and I do think the present conflict has done much to change public opinion, because I think the general public has witnessed the destruction of Gaza and the suppression of human rights in the rest of Palestine by Israel in a way which they had not seen previously. And this, coupled with the Human Rights Watch report, which identifies Israel as an apartheid state, I think it's also having an impact on international and public opinion.
If I could, and I promise to let you go after this, I just wanted to ask you, there is a shift in public opinion in the U.S. that we're really seeing come out in full force now. I think there's still a lot of Americans that are afraid of being labeled anti-Semitic. And I don't think that criticism of the state of Israel is anti-Semitic. I don't think people like yourself who have been accused of anti-Semitism are in any way anti-Semitic. I think you respect the memory of the Holocaust and, you know, the rest of it. What would you say to people, though, that are afraid of being labeled anti-Semites?
Well, first of all, let me comment on the United States. I think that if one looks at the Jewish community in the United States today, it is evenly divided. Many of the most outspoken critics of Israel today in the United States are Jewish. The main problem in the United States is the evangelical community, which is vigorously supportive of Israel. And of course, Netanyahu realizes this. This is why Netanyahu realizes that his main support comes from the evangelicals and not from the Jewish community. But to come to your question, I think that it's important that one stresses the difference between criticizing Jews as Jews, which is anti-Semitic, and criticizing the actions of the Israeli government, which is a political criticism and is completely legitimate. And one has to draw that distinction. And it's very important that those who are responsible for educating the world community today engage in this task.
Well, I want to thank you again, John Degard, for being so generous with your time. And if there's anything else you want to say in closing, feel free.
I think I've said all that needs to be said. Thank you for inviting me. I'm very pleased to have had this opportunity to speak to an American audience, because I do think that American public opinion is tremendously important. And when there's a shift in American public opinion, there will ultimately be a shift in American governmental policy, and this will result in justice for the Palestinians. Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with John Degard and the rest of our conversations in the Parallax Views series on the Israel-Palestine conflict this week. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, as always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,